book. But I'm not getting any money from that, because you know that Glover doesn't pay any royalties. It's just do it for the glory of it. Okay. thank you very much, the Institute, in general, for giving me this opportunity here. My talk is going to be more words than equations. I hope you don't mind if at some stages I'm going to be pictorial and naive, but I would like to get across the message about the conceptual ideas that are behind our attempt to construct an extension of quantum mechanics that builds the second law of thermodynamics directly into it, without contradicting any of the successes of quantum mechanics. So that's the challenge. And I'm going to start with this is the outline. I'll try to motivate this new theory from a conceptual point of view. Then I'll go into two basic ansatz of this thing that we call quantum thermodynamics. And then we describe some of the features of the Kirchhoff theory. As you will see, the first ansatz is an extension of the kinematics of therefore all mathematical entities that represent states. The second is an extension of the Schrödinger dynamics to include steepest entity ascent irreversible dynamics. In such a way, we build entropy and irreversibility into the foundations at the fundamental level, same level as the great energy conservation principles. And then some of the features are like that is equation that we're going to postulate also as a variational formulation. We'll see some numerical examples. We'll see how the unitary evolutions of pure states emerge from these dynamics. We'll talk a little bit, very little, about the question of mathematical reversibility and the arrow of time. And if I have time, I'll just go very quickly over something. Nice title, but sort of a trivial result, it's time energy and time entropy and uncertainty relations. And finally, since you're a group about theory, I left the measurable results at the end, but they are certainly important, and I need to mention them. Okay. Let me start from very well-known concepts, but I'd like to discuss about them without having a mathematical picture in mind. So this is going to be the challenge for today. We talk about a preparation system, and then we use that preparation to make identical copies of that system at a given instant in time. We are non-relativistic theory. And so we generate an ensemble of identical systems all prepared by the same preparation. This preparation can include tossing of coins or anything, any Maxwell thing inside that does any kind of trick. And now we need to characterize this preparation. And we do it by figuring some measurement procedures. The measurement procedures are going to give some answers. So we build up statistics, an histogram of all the possible outcomes. So they're typically the eigenvalues of your associated operator. And then, for example, for each of the eigenvalues, we can associate a question type observable, yes, no observable, whose mean value is going to be the probability of the outcome of that possible answer of the system when I subject it to measurement. Of course, in order to characterize completely the statistics of that preparation, I need to repeat this procedure for all conceivable measurement procedures that you can think of. Once I'm done with all conceivable, so this might even be an infinite series of measurements. I've done also all conceivable measurements, so I know everything that can be conceived of at that instant of time from my preparation. The set of numbers, so all these probabilities associated with each of the possible outcomes of all possible procedures of measurement, that set of numbers, being a characteristic of the preparation, is what I would call, I cannot call it the state, but I call it the preparation. It's the thing that completely characterizes the preparation. So it's tantamount to the preparation. So I like preparation equals, or ensemble, because it's the same, the one-to-one, is the list of values of all possible outcomes of all possible events. Okay. Now we need, because we want to deal with the possibility that a preparation is built up by a statistical composition of two component preparations, I need to give a rule to represent this kind of statistical composition. When you do measurement, you do the procedure that we have on the other slide on this preparation, it's clear that since the result of measurements is averaging over repeated things, this formally basically is going to be the outcome. So the state, or actually the preparation of the overall situation here, is going to be a weighted sum of the component preparation. That's just a consequence of this mean being a weighted sum of the means. Now we go to the phenomenon concept of homogeneity of preparation, or mostly heterogeneity of a preparation or an ensemble. We say that preparation is homogeneous if there is no way to conceive of it as being formed or composed by two different preparations. So this is the formal or maybe mathematical way of defining homogeneous preparation. If you find a way to decompose your preparation into two other preparations with the weights that are different from zero, if your preparation is homogeneous, then those component preparations are identical and are equal to your preparation. This was the important step that from Neumann that I introduced. And that's how, after that, he defined the statistical density of Pennington. And why is this important? The fact that you cannot subdivide your ensemble into sub-ensembles that are different statistics allows you to associate the entire statistics to individual members of the ensemble in a safe way. This was Feynman's idea. There is no other way to subdivide the ensemble. So each member system has its own statistics. And it was important at that stage because we had to distinguish between what I would call intrinsic statistics, that are typical of the quantum nature of states, and the extrinsic statistics that are typical of the tossing of the coin of statistical preparations, or of our not being certain as to which one is the true state of the system. So we need to distinguish between intrinsic and extrinsic, brings out this concept. On the other hand, there are other well-known results that were immediately discovered by Schrödinger, and then later on forgotten for a while, and then starting from 1976, they've been rediscovered, and they are still being rediscovered at times on and off. The fact that if you want to to represent the concept of individual state, it's not enough that your preparation be indecomposable into different preparations, but you also need that if you have a heterogeneous preparation, that one must be decomposable in only one way into the composition of homogeneous ones. Why? Because this is the situation that it's not perfect. Suppose I have a preparation pi, and suppose it decomposes into two homogeneous ones. So the not there means that it's homogeneous. And so the first one prepares the yellow state and the pink one, the pink state. So by looking at this decomposition, since you want to assign homogeneous preparations to states, you are going to infer that the state is either yellow or pink. Now, if the same preparation admits also of another decomposition, again, two homogeneous components, but this one prepares either the green or the red state, then your conclusion from this point of view is that the state is either green or red. Well, these two statements contradict each other. That was the point that Schrödinger singled out immediately, but somehow we kept it under the rug for a long time because the mathematics of Neumann works to describe equilibrium states. And so we got great successes, and we didn't have to bother about conceptual things. All right, so here's the traditional construction. Mechanics. We deal with homogeneous preparations, so the states, okay, we have a system, here's classical of phase space, or quantum of hyperspace. The state or the homogeneous preparation is a point in phase space or a vector in hyperspace, and observables are the usual either functions over phase space or operators or functionals, linear functionals, so on hyperspace. Here's the statistical mechanics Alan von Neumann, where he, for heterogeneous preparation, he says, well, we should use the density of the vector. But if you subject structure to the second criterion for identifying individual states, for having a theory which is compatible with the concept of individual state, unless you want, and I know there is a claim even recently, even by maybe someone of you here, that believes that we should even talk about state. I'm an old-fashioned person, and I think that the concept of state should be saved because it has been one of the keystones of classical thinking. And before I give it up, I want to be very convinced that we do have to do it. So if you subject that to the test of unique decomposition, this thing fails. One way to look at it, for a two-level system, it's like in the Bloch sphere. It's here. You know the Bloch in the Bloch sphere. I have the density operator represented by there. These are the sigma value operators, and this is just the three vector. So I at this point, which represents the three vector, inside sphere represents the density operator. Now, one way, there are many ways that Schrödinger had it already at the beginning to show this multiple decomposition. One way is the following. Suppose you take any state on the surface of the block sphere. Then you take a ray that, from that state, and so that, that's a pure state. And that's what is associated according to Feynman to the homogeneous preparations. So that's the true state. Now I take a ray that goes from that one through raw to the other side of the sphere. And that gives me another pure state. And, well, I can by some kind of lever rule, I can find that rho can be written as a linear combination of these two states with some ways that you can figure out what they are. The problem is that now I choose another state, say that one. They take another ray to the other side, and then you can write the same rho as a linear combination of those two other things. You're interested in the spectral decomposition, then you take a ray that goes to the center of the sphere, and where it crosses the sphere at both ends, those are the vectors of the density operator. So you got, and even for the two-level system, you got an infinity of ways of decomposing your statistical operator. So, quantum statistical mechanics of a phenomenon does not conform to the desiderata of the globally constant of individual state. But, on the other hand, it's very successful describing a thermodynamic equilibrium data because these objects do the right job. You can use whatever rule to come up with these ones, which mathematically are both maximized by rho subject to the energy, the mean energy value. At least you get the canonical or the mean energy and the mean number of particles, you get the canonical equilibrium density distribution, and then depending on the symmetries of your inner space and the Hamiltonian, you get the three types of statistics. This is so successful that people have been willing to hide under the rug the conceptual problem. This is my view, of course. Not everybody should agree on this. So on again on the blocks on the block representation, the canonical equilibrium states. Okay, the Hamiltonian operator is represented by a vector like this vector H here, and the canonical density operators are all the points on this diameter that goes from north to south pole of the sphere. And this is the expression for the end. Okay? I can plot on this diagram the entropy of those equilibrium states as a function of the energy, the dimensions. And this is the well-known Ebers-Husserl's diagram that we use a lot in our book, but this diagram was developed by Ramsey long ago, and it was the first one that showed the sub-existence of negative temperature states. Okay, so how do we, what do we propose to do? We want to save the mathematics and also regain the concept of state. So the idea is the following. We transfer the density operator from here to there, So we basically assume that the density operator is not the mathematical object that you need to represent heterogeneous preparations, but it's the mathematical object that you need to represent homogeneous preparations. And this assumption is the way that you basically build in entropy that goes with the mixing properties of the density operator into the fundamental depth, into the individual states, because homogeneous preparations means individual states of the systems. The first guy is to present you, to make that assumption together with you see, that's a long series of papers in 1976, together with lots of theorems and good thinking about how that takes care, is compatible with the laws of thermodynamics in particular. It allows you to take this into Alright, so now that we have transferred the density operator from here to there, we are left with an empty box here. And the way to fill it is to do something that, you've done in classical theory. You, instead of defining a probability distribution over a phase space there, here you define a probability distribution over the set of density operators, the nature. And in that way, since the measure can always be decomposed in an integral of Dirac measures, the Dirac measures are those that have a single point in the support, you regain the uniqueness of the decomposition. That hasn't been developed so much, it was an idea already presented in this paper by Park and Ban in 1976. I sort of repeated it then in 1981, and somebody else is working on it now.
From a group point of view, you can't tell the difference though between two different mixtures of those things if they give rise to the same effective mathematics.
Depends if, well,
you know, piece of case.
It depends on what you think about the list of say to do the tomography, to represent to do enough measurements to determine a heterogeneous preparation. According to this picture, you may not be sufficient what we usually need to represent the density operator. That was for density operator you need d squared minus one operators. Here you might need an infinity of measurements.
But you might need infinity measurements.
Yeah, because it's a because the set of the density operators is continuous.
So here,
you need an infinity of measurement to represent to measure a continuous function, which is a probability distribution function. So it's not the same kind of difficulty that you already have in classical statistical analysis. How many measurements are needed to figure out the a Gibbs Boltzmann distribution? But I understand this is what I meant when I said, well, you know, think of it in the first line when you said that you're talking about the quorum of observables or tomography, as they call it now. Don't think about it in terms of the density operator. Think about it in terms of the concept of the preparation. Okay. So let's now move more. Let's go on. I lost lost some characters, right, but it doesn't matter. In any case, this is getting the block sphere. This is the state. According to mechanics, the states are only those on the surface of the block sphere, the pure states. And we are talking here, I'm restricting myself to the study of truly isolated system. By truly, I mean non-interacting and non-correlated with anything else in the universe. The situation where in quantum mechanics you would say the state is pure. And of course, the time evolution Schrödinger equation can be written in this. Of course, not lost the symbols. I don't know why, but well, if we now assume that full density operators are needed to represent states, even for such isolated and uncorrelated system, which is the key of Diazopoulos and Niftopoulos assumption. Well, we go inside, and the isentropic surfaces inside are the concentric spheres up to the center where the entropy is scaled up to. Now, if I consider, for example, a plane that cuts the sphere at constant energies, all the states in this plane are the same in the mean energy, I can build up my energy versus entropy diagram. And as I go, as this plane cuts the internal spheres, I go higher in entropy up to a maximum which is reached at the level of entropy where the sphere is tangent to the plane. That's the highest, the maximum entropy state for the DNS. Now I change the value of energy and I reconstruct again that curve. Now the important, okay, again we find the maximum entropy states coincide with those of statistical mechanics. So in that we go with a different interpretation, but we get the same mathematics. So we just need to reinterpret the mathematics, and we are done as far as equilibrium states concerned. But all the other states inside the sphere are the most interesting ones, because the non-equilibrium states, and they are most interesting because the important question that I know concerns some of you here and us also, is how much energy can I extract at constant entropy, or in an adiabatic process, or in a unitary process, if you have any questions of this kind. How much can I go down in this diagram? This is what we, in thermodynamics, we call adiabatic availability. And that's, that has been for starting from Carnot, the concern of the engineering community regarding thermodynamics. That's how engineers have built thermodynamics. So if this is the time evolution on the surface of the sphere, described by the Schrödinger equation, we do not want to deny that also because the successes not only being on the diameter north pole of the sphere, which is equilibrium, you know, but also on the surface. I mean, unitary evolution, people are applying it every day in labs, quantum optics, and so on. And as long as you manage to prepare your state, then you're going to observe a unitary evolution. So to summarize, here's the situation. So if entropy is an intrinsic property of matter, and so if we enlarge the domain of states to include the non-idempotent density operators, so inside of the sphere, Then we have a question. Well, how we know how the states evolve on the surface of the sphere? How do they evolve in time? Inside, how do they have to evolve? Do we have to construct a set of criteria, or we have to guess or infer from experimental data a law for the motion of the states inside? And this is the equation of motion that I developed in my doctoral thesis a while ago, 1981, to resolve this problem. And this is what it this is how it looks for the two-level system of the qubit. I think there is also an animation that definitely says that on this diagram, you see the equation keeps the energy constant and drives you smoothly to the maximum entropy at the given energy. It's interesting that it spirals to the center, it never gets there. It gets there exponentially. As time goes to infinity. And also, if you go backwards in time, the spiral never gets to the boundary, because the boundary solution is a limit cycle of the equation. You get closer and closer to it as time goes to minus infinity. But if you start on the sphere, you remain on the sphere. So that equation.
What was the equation? Just the
now it started. Just a second. Come on. Then we want to go there. Let me do this. Let's that's the question. This is written for say in general. It's a way of writing it. Basically, it is a linear combination. There is an additional term to the Hamiltonian, the usual unitary kind of term. This is rho of rho as an operator, or operator. This is rho, and this is the anti-commutative with the Hamiltonian. And these are just functionals. And you have to interpret this as you calculate the determinant. So the first term is rho of rho itself, with 1 over tau. And then the second is rho by certain function of rho, very nonlinear function of rho. And the third term is like the anti-commutative multiplied by another nonlinear function of rho.
So how did you get this equation? Was it unique under some constraints?
Okay, I'm getting over it, yes. I did it geometrically, in the sense of looking for the direction, adding a term that takes you orthogonally to the unitary evolution towards maximal, in the direction of maximal increase. And I'll show you also a variation of principal kind of formulation. But just to get a nice quotation, in that paper by 1936, where Schrödinger points out the problem of the nonlinearness of the physical condition, he said in the domain in which the present theory, which the present theory does not cover, there is room for new assumptions without necessarily contradicting the theory in that region that is backed up backed by expert and in our point of view that's the room for the new assumption is the inside of the block space. Let me move to the an N level or a 2-bit kind of situation where course, we don't have the blocks here, so I just deploy, say you have something like that, some kind of hypersphere, and the end states, the outer states, and certainly the sort of the crust of this hypersphere are the zero entropy states, those of the standard quantum mechanics. If I add the inside, I add basically entropy as something that goes from zero to a maximum for every value of the energy. And then if the number of levels is finite, so I have an upper bound in the Hamiltonian operator, then I get these negative temperature states. If there is no upper bound, the inverse S curve goes up like that. And this, the use of this diagram for engineering purposes is described in that book. Now, talking about a D-level or an N-level system, I like to think of this in a sort of a pictorial way. Let's, for a moment, simplify the situation and consider density operators that commute with the Hamiltonian, so that I can give a simple interpretation to the eigenvalues of density operator. And also so that the mean value of the energy can be written as this graded sign of the eigenvalues times the energy, times the eigenvalues of the density operator. So I like to think of the of those eigenvalues as measure, each one of them measures the, is associated with, can be associated with one of the eigenvalues of the energy, and it measures the degree of involvement of that internal mode of your system in sharing the energy load. And if you take that view, then entropy becomes an overall measure of the global degree of sharing inside your atom of system. So that, for example, if you have all the energy in just one mode, so in just one eigenvalue, you are at zero entropy. If you have the best distribution in the sense of maximally maximal sharing, it's the canonical distribution. And then you got, if you select one value of the entropy, here in this point the entropy is fixed, the energy is fixed, but you got many possible distributions that give you that value. These are the interesting situations, because here you have, if you're quick enough in doing your limitary evolution, you may be able to go lower in energy and extract some energy, something useful. This is also, I like this because paradoxically people I used to think of that in thermodynamics the best thing is to go very slow. That's not true. In thermodynamics the best thing is to go very fast and beat irreversibility. So you have to extract your work when you have the ability to do it. If you let time go, this thing will redistribute and will tend to the canonical distribution. And if you're here, then you lost your opportunity.
Just one thing.
Yes.
You've got that with probability, DJ, but if I understand right, these P's aren't really probabilities in your model. They're more like physical parameters of the individual system.
Yeah. Yeah, they are getting values of the density operator. But for this class of states, they also represent the probability of, it, like Pj is the probability of outcome of the jth eigenvalue of the Hamiltonian. So you do an energy measurement and you ask your observable, is the question type of observable, is the system showing that eigenvalue? The answer is yes or no. The mean value of that answer is that probability. So it is the probability to get that eigenvalue out of an energy measurement.
So during the evolution of the system as it moves out in this direction, there's a change in the distribution of energies, even though the upgrade remains?
No. The Hamiltonian and the eigenvalues of the energy remain constant. We're talking about an isolated system, so the Hamiltonian operator is fixed.
Okay, so here you're not considering this, you have this equation that changes, that spirals it. Mm-hmm.
That's the now in this case, for this class,
okay.
The Hamiltonian evolution is nil, because rho random is the Hamiltonian.
Okay.
And so the whole of the evolution is done by that additional term, the nonlinear term, which redistributes this degree of sharing so that among, so that it becomes more democratic, so to speak, and everybody, every eigenvalue does a little bit of its profits. I have some more. For example, if I want to construct, what's the criterion if you want to construct an equation that is compatible with what we're trying to do? Suppose you didn't like my equation, you want to try yours or something else. Well, certainly, if you're talking about an isolated system, we need to conserve energy. If we want to obey the laws of thermodynamics, we should never have the entropy decrease if the system is isolated. You can take entropy out of the system, but not if it is isolated. You have to conserve probabilities. I mean, these things have to remain positive and sum up to one. The fact that they have to remain positive is an important fact. For example, we know that if you take like the Lindblad kind of equation, the family of equation, maybe it keeps this in forward in time, but not that. But in addition, and perhaps this is the most restricting requirement. You want this equation we built in so that we so that basically the second law of thermodynamics comes out as a theorem, as a dynamic of theorem. So what statement of the second law do we like? And here, of course, if you go to Wikipedia, you get like 100 statements of the second law. We have our own, and we like this one. I think it's most general. And it says that for each value of the energy, mean energy, there should be one and only one stable equilibrium state. And I take it literally, stating by stability, what do we mean by stability of equilibrium state? In this book, you find a wordy kind of definition saying that the stable equilibrium it cannot be changed without leaving some net effects outside of the system. But here, I'm taking it literally in the sense, in the Lyapunov meaning of stability. I want to construct a dynamical system. I want to look at the equilibrium states, and I want to look at the stability of those equilibrium states according to the definition. Oh yeah, this is the sequence of books what we like to think of a school of thermodynamics that built up during the years around that statement of the second. Which, by the way, has inside, I think, the only place where you find a rigorous axiomatic definition of entropy for non-equilibrium states. I'm sure you've heard many people claim that entropy is defined only for equilibrium states. I disagree. We have that definition. And it has been there for a while, 1991 at least. Here is again the equation. And here is how it looks when the rock moves with age. Basically, you see these are the eigenvalues are already aligned with the arbitrarium, so to speak, so you don't have to... And so this is the rate of change of the eigenvalues of the density operator, which is a function of all the other density operators, a very relatively non-linear function.
Can you start? Sorry, I think I got a little bit lost. On the previous slide, you had the desiderata for the new dynamical law, right? You had these conditions.
Yeah.
So, are you saying that these uniquely fixed dynamical law that you just shown? Is that
yes. Yes, that's my belief. Although it's not so simple to. The uniquely maybe is a little strong. Certainly, it does satisfy the desiderata, and it does it in the strongest way, in the sense that, as you will see in just a couple of slides, we select the rate of change of these probabilities in such a way that it maximizes the rate of production. So it may be that you can find weaker equations that instead of going sort of orthogonal to the constant entropy contours, go
Right. So you're saying if you add in the condition of maximum entropy production as well, then the law that you've got...
Then it becomes unique.
Then it would be
unique. Yeah.
Okay.
But, but in a sense, I don't know of how to physically justify that assumption of maximal entropy production. I like it, because of course that's what it does, but then also it has many nice features, but there has been a lot of discussion in the fluid mechanics community, for example, talking about minimal entropy production or maximal entropy production, which is which, and so I don't know. In any case, this is also the explicit expression for the rate of entropy production, which happens to be a ratio of two positive definite determinants, which are grand determinants, and so we are safe that we have as a theoretical principle of entropy non-decrease. Not only that, you can prove that only the canonical distribution is the stable equilibrium state. All other equilibrium states are, there are other equilibrium states, but they are all unstable. And so we prove as a theorem the uniqueness of the stable equilibrium state for each value of the image. This is just another way of writing, a more elegant way of writing the equation, but the nonlinearity is all hidden here and in row on row. And this projector in front of it that takes care of killing the infinities when the eigenvalues are zero. Yeah.
Just a quick question about, you said that there were other equilibrium solutions which were not stable.
Mm-hmm. I'll show you some examples in a second.
Yeah, I just wonder if you could explain what that means, because we normally think of an equilibrium, I normally think of an equilibrium state as something that is stable. But maybe that's not right.
No. Let me say, if I do like that, I mean, maybe I
can't.
Okay, so this is an equilibrium state, but it's unstable.
Okay.
So here, the situation is that, one of the features you can see immediately here, if one of the eigenvalues is zero, its rate of change is zero. This is important for several reasons. First of all, this is a proof that the Schrödinger equation is a byproduct of this, because the Schrödinger equation has, if you start from a pure state, you've got one eigenvalue which is equal to one, the others are all zero. And if the ones that are all zero remain all zero, you've got to, you remain a pure state. But then you if you look at situations where you have, say, two eigenvalues that are different from zero and the others are all zero, then the equation takes you to the canonical distribution that sort of divides the law, the sharing, between those two eigenvalues only. And that's an unstable equilibrium state, because near that there is another one in which one of the zero eigenvalues becomes epsilon. And if it becomes epsilon, then it moves away from your original equilibrium state. That's the definition of the point of finding a solution that is near yours, but then takes you far away. That's unstable. And so the only one which is stable is the one, is the canonical distribution in which all eigenvalues are different from zero. That's the thermodynamic equilibrium state. This is just for fun to see what this thing does. Of course, see the initial state here. These are not zero, because if they were zero, they would remain zero. I just put a little epsilon, and then the equation takes into equilibrium. And it does so whatever initial density operator you give. In this case, you get the density operator, which is filled in the first and the last eigenvalue and epsilons in the rest. And it distributes the load accordingly. Now, again, about. Oops. Should I finish at 7 hours? No, I'm already out of time.
Well, usually you can carry on until 5:30, although it's about our time for discussion.
Okay. Maybe sort of skip this. This was to show that the trick that in order to conserve the positivity, you can recast the equation in terms of the square root of the eigenvalues. So basically the square root of the density operator. And then you can define this in a variational way by saying, let me select the rate of change of the square root of these probabilities in such a way that it maximizes the rate of entropy increase subject to keeping the energy constant and also keeping the you're looking for the direction in which you should move in order to maximize the entropy. But the rate at which you move remains to be determined, like this time constant that is inside, and it's like an internally distribution time constant of the problem. So that's the variational formulation, and then you do Lagrange multipliers. And by the Lagrange multipliers, you find again that equation of motion. Find the P of P and so on. So, this is a simple way of proving that there is a variation of formulation. Of course, we do it also with operators instead of just. Sorry, I have to go quickly because I promised something that I. Okay. Here is a plot, some numerical examples. As a function of time, I take a four-level system. These are the four probabilities. So I select arbitrarily an initial density distribution. And then I let it evolve the time, and it goes smoothly. The entropy increases. This is the rate of entropy generation. then I reach the equilibrium state. Now, the nice aspect of this equation that is very much related to the fact that the zeros remain zero is that the equation, you can solve it also backwards in time. And so if I take this same state and I go backwards in time, I never go negative for any probabilities because I cannot cross zero. And so I go to the minimal entropy or to the sort of ancestral kind of state of my system. And this I like very much because it's what I associate with the concept of strong causality. I want to, if I know the state of my system, I like to think classically that I can solve everything about it for the end vector. It's entirely history. And also, I like it very much as an example of the fact that this is a very explicit example where even if you solve your equation backwards in time, the time evolution forward in time is irreversible. It's irreversible in the sense that entropy increases, and therefore that the ability of your ability to extract work of the system diminishes with time. That's the physical meaning of entropy. Not the fact that you cannot solve backwards in time. So you don't need a semi-group kind of concept to have that irreversibility. This is a group. These are the structure of the for the four-level system. The outer boundary are the equilibrium, the canonical equilibrium states. These are the structure of all the possible partially canonical equilibrium states, the unstable ones, because these are in each of these ones I have one eigenvalue which is here. Okay, I'll spare the time entropy, and I'll spare the Onsager reciprocity. You can prove that dissipated term in the equation of motion obeys symmetries like Onsager type. And so it's very compatible with non-equilibrium thermodynamics. But you need to consider this summation is not just limited to a few observables, it has to be an entire form of observables. And also these linearities are made up of coefficients which are very non-linear functions of the state operator. So the Onsager relations is not. It's the basis of the so-called linear theory of universal processes. But the linearity, here, this is the linearity relation between like affinities and rates of change. But the matrix of coefficients is very non-linear function of the density of which is nice. And let me conclude with this one and text one. Because there is an entire problem which is how do we deal with composite systems? How do we deal with, since the equation of motion is highly nonlinear, we have to accept a certain number of things. In particular, we have to concern ourselves when Alice and Bob, initially knowing each other, they get to know each other, they interact for a while, and then they go away. Now, forget about math, but the equation for the composite system of Alice and Bob has two terms, and they evolve sort of separately. Then the Hamiltonian, when they start interacting, the Hamiltonian is responsible for building up correlations between them. Now, when they go and they stop interacting and they sort of separate, they go away. Some people in these kind of problems believe that the time evolution, the local time evolution, should depend only on the local density operator. Turns out, at least in the structure that, that I developed, that is, it turns out this is not true. And it is not, I don't think it is a drawback of this equation, because somehow the local evolution of say, Bob, does depend on the correlations that he has built up during the exposure to others. No? And there is no reason why we should ask that he forgets about the interaction that he had with others. In fact, this theory doesn't require so. But of course, what you have to prove, and it was the non-signaling condition, is you have to prove that the local evolution in the Bob has should be totally independent of whatever happens to Alice later on. But it should not be independent of what, of the past interaction between Bob and Alice. And so I conclude with that. These were the measurable effects, and that it can go to that. This was also in 1985. There was an editorial by John Nados, who was the editor then of Nature, which was very nice. He said, we called our scheme an adventurous scheme, which I agree. And it was very nice, his conclusion said, indeed, while for as long as the present justification of the basics of statistical mechanics holds water, there will be many who say that this theory is strictly unnecessary. But this is a field in which the proof of the pudding is in the eating. And I like to say that actually we're still here and the pudding hasn't gone sour yet. Actually, people are rediscovering these ideas. So, with that, thank you.
I have a couple of questions. So, first of all, a technical one. Do you have a Lorentz invariant version of any of this?
No. Okay, you can prove there is a the person who rediscovered that in 2001, she has proven that if you take, like Galilean class invariants, you take a free particle and you add, in addition to energy conservation, you have to add also the momentum conservation. So the equation, the structure of the equation that I've shown, that is the determinant, as additional lines, if you want to conserve other things, in addition to the Hamiltonian, you want to put the number of operators, or you want to put the momentum, the, like px, py, pz. If you do that, then you've got Galilean invariants. That's as far as I understand it.
So the second question, I guess, was more a conceptual thing. Is the entire universe in a mixed state? State.
That's a very nice question. And it drives to how do you prove that these mixed states do exist? How do we find an experiment, or how do we design, or even a conceptual experiment to show that these things exist? And that's, so far, I believe this is the reason why the pudding is still there, because you haven't proved either yes or no. We don't know. So as far as the moment you find it, you find that experiment and somebody does it, then you can disprove this theory. Until that moment, it's just an alternative, which I happen to like more. Somebody else dislikes it, and so it's a matter of taste. I agree with you, it's a very fundamental question.
can I follow up on that? It is on the nature of them experimental tests. I mean, it would seem to me that this, because it does propose a different evolution, that you can look, you should be able to look for them. They would obviously have the same kind of problems as the search for objective collapse theories in terms of you've got a shield from all kinds of decoherence. But as there is work and interest in looking into decoherent, into objective collapse models, presumably the same kind of experimental situations might be ones where you could look at these kind of effects.
So the theory says if you have a pure state of an isolated system, it evolves according to the correct Schrodinger equation. Mm-hmm. And it says if you have a mixed state, then it evolves towards the equilibrium state. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't see how that's possible to distinguish, right? Even conceptually, right? I mean, so GRW will say funny things will happen to pure states. This says if you have an absolutely totally pure state, nothing funny will happen. And then if you have a mixed state, then you don't know where the mixedness is coming from.
Well, yeah, but there is a difference, because if you have, clearly, if the entire universe is in a pure state, then this theory says nothing different to standard quantum mechanics, because all the extra terms of this theory add to it go to zero and disappear, so it makes these efforts completely. So to have any content, you have to assume that the universe is in a mixed state, mm-hmm. is in a density matrix. But the density matrix there is going to evolve differently to a density matrix you would get by forming a statistical mixture of two pure states.
Yes.
Because each pure state will evolve according to this theory as a pure state of standard evolution and wouldn't become too mixed.
Yes.
But equally, a density matrix that is a partial trace of a pure state evolves differently from a fundamental mixed state too.
If you have a density matrix which is of a system which is correlated with something else, then I don't think you can apply this theory. I think you go back to include all other systems, and until you got a truly isolated system, and then you need to know whether the state of this truly isolated system is pure. Yes. So you go back to the same question.
That would potentially be a problem. And in the sense in which it's a difficulty to know what predictions this model would make, because if it really fundamentally requires to know what's going to happen to this system, you actually do have to know whether there is some mixed, some entanglement of the density matrix with mm-hmm. the rest of the world. I mean, it's hard to know how you could actually isolate that for any system.
Yeah, I mean, we have no way of knowing how to make a this theory asserts that there are mixed states, which are just fundamentally mixed states. It's not because of that you've been given coins, it's not because it's entangled with something else. We have no idea how to make such a thing, or how to distinguish it from.
Well, if you had such a state, I mean, if you were to assume you had actually managed to isolate a system, then you would be able to distinguish it developing according to this law than whether it was a statistical mixture. They would make different predictions.
Sure, but if you don't find it evolving according to this law, then your excuse could always be, that thing I declared wasn't the fundamental.
Sure, that makes it harder to rule out. But on the other hand, if you do see it evolving differently, then this theory suggests that is rather strong evidence.
I agree. I mean, you can rule in the theory if you see things evolving according to the equations of the theory.
I see the same difficulty that you were saying before, because you would have it when you prepare a true state. How do you check that you really have a true state?
You never really prepare a true state.
Right.
I mean, there can be an infection, you would do it by demography or something.
Okay. Here you have to, when you do tomography, you should not stop at measuring things at one instant of time, you should also measure the rate of change with time. That might sort of help. Usually, if you presume unitary evolution, you do tomography and then from the state, you know how it goes forward. But if you don't know the state evolution, you have to measure also the rate of change. I don't know, people of planning, but people that are thinking of that, because everybody's so used to unitary evolution. And if they see the departure from it, they don't think that it may be a sort of internal thing, but it's due to something else, like interactions or disturbance and the moon and so on.
What is the time constant, the tau in the... Have you got bounds on that?
That's another thing. From the mathematics, it could be constant, or it could also be a positive function of this value of density of L. Okay, so that's quite open. From the physics point of view, the only idea that I have about looking for bounds is from the Boltzmann equation, because when you derive a Boltzmann equation, you go from, say, with quantum from the unitary evolution, and then you describe these particles that collide, and then before the next collision, they have to lose the correlations that they build up during the collision. You want just the two, the Boltzmann, standard Boltzmann equation. Otherwise, if you want to consider like the hierarchy of equations, but at a certain point you have to truncate. And in order to support the truncation, you need to have a term like that which kills the coherence and the correlations from one collision to the next. And since the Boltzmann equation is successful in describing gases to a certain, depending on the dilution, that should give you a bound on how strong that term should be if you assign to it the charge load of doing the of justifying the Boltzmann equation. But this is just words. I'd have to see it work out.
And the equation that you wrote down for the two systems, the bipartite system, mm-hmm. was that just a very obvious thing to write down, given?
Not at all.
No. So what additional assumptions were, I mean, again, how uniquely sort of constrained is that?
Okay. It's still maximal, it's in a sense local, maximal entropy production. But then the whole difficulty is to define what you mean by local, especially when you have your system which is entangled or related to something else. So the trick was done by, what do you want to define a bit? Forget about that. The trick is done by these two, the last two lines, where S is log of rho. It's log of rho a little bit adapted to avoid the zeros. And this operator takes the partial traces over all other systems in the universe except your J system. And it gives you what I call as the local perception of the overall entropy of the system. So each system maximizes the rate of entropy production according to its local perception of the overall entropy, which might not be the overall entropy. So this is the trick. And also for the energy, if the systems are interacting, you don't know where to assign the interaction energy to which part. So it also defines, this let's say, the Hamiltonian operator. This is the way to define a local perception of the Hamiltonian. So a local perception of the overall entropy, energy of the system. And that is the object which is conserved by... So each subsystem has its own local internal mechanism to redistribute things in such a way as to maximize its local perceptions of of overall entropy subject to conserving local perception of overall energy. That's the idea. On the other hand, it's not easy because the nonlinearity doesn't allow you to do like we do for a unitary evolution, same structure, not common. The nonlinearity forces you to build the structure of your system also in the dynamical equation, not only in the Hamiltonian.
Just one question about experimental tests. You had a slide where you looked like you were going to talk about. I wonder if you could just talk about that.
Yeah. If you take a beam of atoms, people were doing experiments spectroscopy. They take a very diluted beam of atoms, so basically in your apparatus you have one atom at a time. And you go about resonance, so you single out two levels of that atom, so basically you've got a two-level system. Now, suppose I can prepare, this is the difficulty, suppose I know how to prepare a truly mixed, so I take it out of an oven, in my idea, out of an oven, it should come out in a thermodynamic equilibrium state. So that's the way to prepare a truly mixed density operator. So I put it there, and I use a pump, a laser, slightly detuned off resonance, and then I have a detector here, which probes the resonance fluorescence out of the anode. The dark line is the standard, how do you call it, Kimball and Molo kind of resonance fluorescence. Spectral resolution of resonance fluorescence. These are the two stark shifted peaks. If you got the parameter tau in the equation, which is different from zero, I worked out this quite ago, and it gets some asymmetries in this spectral thing. So that's one way of looking at it. But of course, if you try to go and convince some experimentalists, well, why don't you do this? And they say, well, of course, we know, we find the symmetries, but they are due to, and they start enumerating the kind of the noise and disturbances that account for symmetries. So the question is that there is no way you can convince an experimentalist to check your theory unless you convince him of the usefulness of your theory. Because the typical answer I got, well, I don't believe in your theory, so I'm not going to waste my time doing experiments in something that I don't believe in. So you have to do some selling. And this is a similar situation, where same situation, but now the pump is on resonance, and you probe it with a weaker probe, and you see stimulated emission or absorption. When this thing goes negative, this is stimulated emission. And here it's even more difficult because it's not asymmetries, but it simply reduces a little bit or largely the stimulated emission effect. It kills, basically, if it is large enough, it kills the stimulated emission. This is an internal redistribution.
So basically the systems that you're using here are those in maximum entropy mixed states. Is that?
Well, no. What comes in here in the Fignon group to obtain these results are not the stable equilibrium, because otherwise I'm close to it, though.
How do you get close to it as opposed to at it?
No, I take sort of the linearization of the nonlinear equation close to equilibrium. Basically, it becomes what some people call it, like the block or law equation, law. So the equation boils down to like rho minus rho equilibrium divided by tau. Okay, it's a linearization. Tau sometimes something else. And so so this is valid only if you are sufficiently close to thermodynamic equilibrium. It's a very complicated calculation because it's already complicated to do the quantum electrodynamics under unitary evolution. If you add the length term, it makes it even more complicated. So I assume that if you want to repeat this very far from equilibrium using the full non-linearity, you're going to have to do it in radical. Right? This was done analytically.
So for the gravity Ridley Weber model of collapse, there's very experiment considered. And one experiment is, so I think the numbers are something like if you have a mole of hydrogen atoms in ground state, then because of the collapse process, with the numbers they give, you would expect like 10 photons to be given off per second. Just because if an atom is sitting in its ground state, and he gets hit with this collapse process, there's some probability it will be excited to a higher state and then decay. And you might have something similar here. So if an atom is in a mixed state, or it's a mixture over a mixture over some low energy states, then if it has very low weight on the higher energy elements of that mixture, that weight will increase. And you'll presumably see emission of photons from atoms. And that presumably is what would happen. So that would be they need to put some limits on tau or some parameters perhaps.
Yes, I don't know.
I think it's the opposite. Because like the way you normally think of the system approaching the microwave is because it's interacting with some other force and heat bar, the electromagnetic field or whatever, and so you would normally think that for a higher energy level to go lower, you would have to emit some photons. But here you're saying there's a fundamental process that does it for an isolated system, and so the thing will go to thermal equilibrium without emitting stuff that it would have otherwise. I mean, that's the way around, I think.
So you get the emission of photons. I mean, the system in complete isolation would go to a thermal equilibrium at the same average energy. Getting emission of photons, you have to then have it interacting with a electromagnetic field that is actually at a lower temperature, and that's how you see the emissions.
But I was just saying that I think that I would have thought the rate of emission would be lower than
it would be different. Yeah. It would also expect to be different because, of course, the GRW theory isn't guaranteed to conserve energy, whereas it's by construction it's guaranteed to conserve energy.
This conserves average energy, it doesn't conserve moments of energy. So non conservation moments of energy would lead to stability, to emission of energy.
Yeah, but you would have to include the electromagnetic field as another system, like Alice and Bob. Alice is your system and Bob is the
electromagnetic field. It's a more complicated calculation.
Yeah. And Bob is very system. No, I mean, in principle, it can be done. It's tedious, but...
I have some more questions that I want to actually carry on asking you about. We've reached part five, so I guess we should continue in this.
Great.